This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 3rd of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up on the show this week, we see what happens when a household name in Britain joins forces with an Italian legend to help up its game abroad.
They have a fantastic savoir-faire, fantastic capacity to touch this wood.
We discuss 14 post-war office blocks that have just been saved from the wrecking ball in the UK.
Certainly it does mean that they've been appreciated, people are trying very hard to understand what's special about them. The government has flagged them up as being something worth having a good look at.
And then we toast the 65th birthday of the Clark's Desert Boot and meet a few designers who are helping mark the occasion.
When it first was launched, it was regarded as being a little bit louche, but then was quickly adopted by lots of people who wore it because it was incredibly versatile.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Urquhart is a British furniture manufacturer that began life in 1920. It's largely a household name in the UK, where generations grew up sitting for dinner on its bentwood chairs, at its wonderfully rounded oak tables, or, of course, perched with a loved one on its slatted back love seats. Urquhart has a rich history and an enviable portfolio, but remains relatively unknown outside the UK and has a minuscule export business. A new collection of sofas called Nest, which showed at Maison et Objet in Paris last month, is hoping to change that. It's a new collaboration with respected Italian designer Paola Navone, who has designed pieces for everyone from Cappellini to Crate and Barrel. Can an internationally recognised name, plus a bit of Italian flair, help take Urquhart global? I chatted to Paola at the Urquhart stand in Paris. So let's start with how the collaboration came about. I mean, you've had Urquhart in your home for a while.
Yes, all the piece I was always looking this beautiful, always considering the factory like a temple, big reference for my work. Then I was buying in the antique market in very expensive Urquhart old chair. That was before. Then one day we met somewhere, we don't remember where, and they asked me if I want to do something for Urquhart. So it was a very fascinating situation, but I was a little bit scared because, you know, when you touch such a sophisticated reality, you cannot jump and do whatever is crossing your mind. So I cannot do a metal kind of. So we went to the factory, we went around with my assistant, they were so fascinated, they don't want to go back anymore to Italy. Then we designed this nest. We told them, this is your something that only you can make. You know, all the sections are special, different in every point, etc. And then when we have a nest, you send the next to us, and we will put a cushion in it. Thus, they said the next, we put the cushion, then we called them, they came to see, and that was the surprise.
Have you worked with English companies of this type before, something so simple and careful design?
No. Well, more than careful design, they have a fantastic savoir-faire, fantastic capacity to touch this wood. I mean, all the workers are wood somehow dependent on this wood. So this is very special. I mean, before the design, that's, I think, the technique comes first to me. Then we try to make this little nest, and then we hope to do more. We see now they have to sell.
And in terms of just the colours of the green on the sofa, which is very part of your design vocabulary, how did you go about choosing the colours in the collection?
We make several proposals before, also in the fact that we want to mix this colour in the same sofa, different colour. So we made four ideas, and then they say they like.
And it's sort of four seasons, isn't it? The four tones of colour, would you say?
Yeah, maybe. Yes, this is winter, this is spring, this is summer, this is autumn.
So do you think
I just
that...
I made it up because it was not like this. It wasn't the intention.
And how is, you think, now looking at the end result, the sort of the relationship between great English craftsmanship and your sort of Italian flair?
My opinion is positive because we like to work with them very much. It was very easy at the end, the relationship. Result, from our point of view, is nice. Now we have to wait for to see if they can sell, because that's at the end of the story is what makes things really successful.
What's the perception of Ercole in Italy? I mean, it's a very sort of British brand that's, you know, huge and every day in the UK and has been for decades. What's the understanding of it in Italy?
Not everybody knows Ercole in Italy. The people who are professional knows Ercole, but it's like something very, little bit far away, mythical, something that is not something that everybody is ready to approach.
Well, it is now.
Now we see.
And here we are in Paris at Maison, but obviously our thoughts are soon turning to Milan in April.
Yes.
What is your plan? What have you got? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, I don't know. We have a lot of nice projects in April. So you have to come back. First of all, big party, pizza party. That's the most important. Then an exhibition in Palazzo Reale with Cappellini. And then new collection, Cappellini new collection, Jefferson new collection, Baxter new collection, a lot of things.
That was designer Paola Navone talking to me about her new collaboration with British furniture manufacturer Ercole at the brand stand at Maison et Objets last month in Paris. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. As our listeners will know, we have a soft spot for those bigger, brasher and often greyer buildings of the post-war period. And thankfully, we're not alone. There seems to be a considerable recognition of many residential developments from the 1950s onwards. But the same can't be said for office or commercial buildings of the same period. However, last week, many architecture enthusiasts in the UK at last got some good news. English Heritage, the national body responsible for the protection of architecturally and historically important buildings, announced that 14 additional buildings would be listed or protected as Grade 2. From Birmingham's sleek 1972 Alpha Tower, designed by George Marsh of Richard Seyfert and Partners, to the delicate transparency of the IBM Pilot Head Office in Cosham by Foster Associates in 1977, the list shows variety, ingenuity, and yes, beauty. First, let's hear a short extract of Monocle's Andrew Tuck speaking to the head of designation for English Heritage, Roger Bowdler.
These buildings are really commercially sensitive. They're owned by investment companies. They are very valuable investments. Those people need to know where they stand about what's going to happen to their buildings. So for us to give them the certainty that that one is an exceptionally interesting building and should, ideally, be given to future generations to enjoy as well, they want to know as well. And the great thing is these are wonderful buildings and they're all working really well.
The pace of change in London is unbelievable. And we're seeing so many office buildings turned into residential. Did you feel that there was a kind of an impetus to act now? And you know, I presume that some of these people are keen to see their investments developed in other ways. Is there a bit of a pushback from some of the owners, do you think?
Some people are wary about listing because, let's be honest, it does reduce your options for change. To demolish a listed building is quite a process. It doesn't happen very often. So we've got to admit we are reducing people's freedom. But that said, owners, occupants, they want good buildings. They want to be there. So owners are proud of the best of the architecture that they're lucky enough to own and to manage. So they wanted to know. We gave them the clarity. There were some delicate discussions at first. But I think now there's a lot of relief and a lot of celebration at the buildings that people are working in the capital.
Now, you've chosen some remarkable buildings, but I was interested in something you said earlier today, that you felt that these buildings are also important, not just for how they look, but how they kind of chimed with how work changed and how we viewed work. They're part of our social history as well.
They are. I mean, melancholy to relate, we spend an awful lot of time of our waking hours. I was in my office before it got light today. I left when it was way after dark. That's where we live part of the life. Isn't that a sad thing to say? Of course they matter. So the way we work, highly important, doesn't like history or heritage just deal with castles and abbeys. Oh no, it's about how we all live. And that's what the sort of history people are more and more interested in.
That was Roger Bowdler of English Heritage speaking to Andrew Tuck last week on the news that 14 important post-war office buildings would be protected. To get a better idea of the challenges facing many of this type of building, our David Pleasant went to meet Catherine Croft, Director of Architectural Campaign Group, the 20th Century Society.
They've been identified as being of architectural historic interest. I'd like to think it would mean that they won't ever be demolished or significantly altered, but sadly sometimes that's not the case. We have seen examples of listed buildings being demolished. But certainly it does mean that they've been appreciated. People are trying very hard to understand what's special about them. Government has flagged them up as being something worth having a good look at.
I think a lot of the reaction in this country this morning in the national news and media was something of a kind of not trivia story, but something, isn't it a surprise that these ugly buildings have made it onto this list? There's always that sort of reaction in the British press. Are you kind of seeing that change, or are you still a little bit flabbergasted when you sort of see this kind of commentary about, you know, what are these heritage boffins up to kind of saving this kind of stuff?
I think it's really interesting because the coverage this morning, I mean, it made it onto the national news on the radio programme this morning on Radio 4. And it wasn't a sort of silly story. It was, you know, this has happened. And the basic tenor of the piece was that this is good news. But the journalists still managed to refer to them all as concrete buildings, you know, and some of them are concrete and some aren't. But there's this kind of assumption that if they're post-war commercial buildings, then they must be concrete. And also they said, oh, they wouldn't win any prizes for any beauty prizes. So that the idea being that they're listed more for their historic interest than their architectural finesse. But I mean, I think actually it's an amazing list of really attractive buildings.
Maybe let's describe to the listeners some of them. There's incredible variety there. One that's coined the Hanging Gardens of Basingstoke, rather kind of ironically, I think. So maybe describe some of the techniques, some of the styles that are represented in that list of 14.
Yeah, most of them are basically modernist buildings, and the Hanging Gardens of Basingstoke is great. I mean, and actually that's been put on a special register for parks and gardens of interest as well, because it really is kind of complete integration of building and landscape. And it, you know, lots of people know about it because you can see it from the mainline train. And it's basically lots of staggered decks of office buildings. You know, so the whole idea that everybody gets to look out onto a big, wide, generous balcony, and the whole thing is like a sort of verdant hillside. I think it's a kind of real reaction to the idea of the city being all hard surfaces and tough materials.
And do you think if we look more broadly, there's obviously many more buildings out there, and it seems that the last few years with the economy picking up in this country, particularly with construction again in boom, are these types of buildings more at risk than ever before?
Yeah, I definitely think the economy picking up has had a big impact. And, you know, we're talking about buildings on the whole that are right in the middle of city centres and where pressures for redevelopment are the highest. So, and also quite a lot of the buildings of this period were, you know, they were quite tall, but buildings nowadays are going up twice as high, so that the land values that you can realise by demolishing and redeveloping are huge.
Maybe let's kind of talk in more broad terms about buildings from this era. Of course, there's 14 that are selected today. There are many more. Maybe tell us about your organisation, what campaigns are keeping you occupied, what kinds of buildings you'd like to see added to this list.
It's a great list, but there are, you know, obviously there are lots of buildings I'd love to have seen on it that didn't make the grade. And in particular, there are two buildings by John Maiden, who was a commercial architect in Birmingham, which have been turned down. They've been assessed as part of the process and turned down, including the NatWest Tower. So major bank headquarters right in the middle of Birmingham, which is really great, craggy sculptural building. And it has fabulous doors by a sculptor called Bill Mitchell, whose work I really admire. And that's the building that I would have just loved to have seen maybe made into a residential conversion. It would have been, you know, it could have been amazing, a flat conversion. But that looks very much as though it will now be demolished.
And finally, and I'm sure you'll say you can't possibly answer a question like this, but was there a kind of favourite that slipped through that you were surprised by, or you were particularly relieved by, if you look at that list of 14, that you kind of raised your eyebrows when you saw that got in?
I really like the building that was built for the Crédit Lyonnais in the city on Cannon Street, which has this amazing arched facade, which is all done in fibreglass, basically. And I was worried about that one because it's not by a sort of academic, respected architect who is known as a sort of fine art architect. It's by a commercial firm. And I think it's always harder to get those buildings that are straight commercial buildings rather than those with a, you know, respectable knighted architect behind them.
So it's a sort of kind of familiar friend to a lot of people who might be walking past, but as you say, it has no kind of great name for itself, as it were.
Yeah, and it's a fun building rather than a sort of intellectually serious building. I think that's, you know, a lot of the buildings on this list are by Arup Associates, who are a fantastic firm of architects, but they are really serious architects who took the tenets of modernism very, very thoroughly, and their architecture is very rigorous, and it's about beautiful detailing. They're kind of like the BMW of architecture, or whereas this is some flash, slightly cheap sports car, maybe.
Well, it's lovable all the same. It's a fantastic corner building that's really quite distinctive. You wouldn't really think it's London. It might kind of be Beirut or Paris or something.
Well, and it's for a French bank. You know, it's a bit of kind of continental flair come to London.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Catherine Croft, Director of Campaign Group, the 20th Century Society. We've been having an in-depth look at the fate and challenges facing post-war commercial architecture. As we were hearing about from Catherine there, one building to be listed, or officially protected, here in London is 30 Cannon Street, built for French bank Crédit Lyonnais by Winnie, Sun and Astle Hall in 1974. The Section D team brave the winter chill to find out what the office workers who use this building think of their place of work. And here are some of the very varied opinions.
I'm Matthew. I'm an artist. Right now I'm doing accountancy at 30 Cannon Street. I'm surprised at this building over some of the other ones in the city, some of the postal ones made it through it. I hadn't realised it was had any architectural significance until my partner, who's an architect, when I told him, said that it was the first glass-fibred, concrete-clad building in the world. It's a very elegant space, actually. It's a very contemporary space.
I'm the financial controller for a finance company. I don't disagree or agree. I don't really have an opinion. I mean, to me, it's a fairly ugly building, but I don't know enough about architecture and the history of architecture to have an informed opinion.
It's quite kind of exciting to hear that the office we work in has been listed. And actually, I think it's quite a nice building. I think kind of a lot of people have said it's maybe not the prettiest building, but I think it's actually quite nice, and it kind of stands out and it's a bit different from kind of other buildings around this area.
John, I work within the building for a publishing company. I know it's been listed as a Grade 2 listed building. They could do something with the air conditioning, to be totally honest.
Those were some of the voices from the office workers at 30 Cannon Street here in London, which, as of last week, is officially protected from demolition. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, where we will be back after this short break.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. One Madison is a 50-storey, 16,000 square metre tower block that rises over Union Square in New York. Part of an ongoing condo craze, Rupert Murdoch has snapped up the top four floors for a shade over $57 million. But the building hasn't always been so coveted. The economic downturn and a change of ownership have mired the project, which started back in 2006 and completed in November 2014, with the final touches being added in the coming months. Monocle's New York bureau chief Ed Stocker met building architect John Setra and interior designer Nancy Ruddy, as well as speaking to a couple of the building's early residents.
Okay, well, we're standing outside One Madison at the 22nd Street entrance. There's quite an unusual facade, isn't there, John?
Yes, it is, actually. It uses a material that is actually quite old in New York City, which is terracotta. There are many buildings that incorporate terracotta detailing in them from the early 1900s right through the 20th century. This building uses the latest technology in the development of terracotta, and it also is used in a novel way as well to blend in with the other buildings on the block. On this side, you can see that we have our neighbor's townhouse from the 1880s that is constructed of limestone, but it has a kind of a creamy color to it, which is quite beautiful. And the idea here was to pick up on that color so that the building would blend in, because 22nd Street is a quieter street. Has a more residential feel to it than the 23rd Street side, which is where the tower sits closer to 23rd Street.
And was there other designers that came up with this facade?
The facade was developed by BKSK Architects, and they came up with the schematic design, and we, as the architect of the building, worked with them to develop the scheme.
Okay, let's get out of this wet, wintry New York afternoon and go inside.
We're the Braun's, Roseanne and Ed Braun. We moved into One Madison 3 or 4 years ago when the building was still under construction. And we lived here through its very checkered history until this moment today when it's opened in its full glory.
The building has beautiful exterior architecture. And in fact, we like the fact that you could see it from outside of Manhattan. We see it from the Long Island Expressway. And now that it's occupied, it's lit up at night, and you get a full appreciation of the exterior facade. And the apartments are enhanced by the fact that there's so much glass. So you see, we're on the center line of Madison Avenue. You see all the way up the length of Madison Avenue. And we're on the 11th floor, so we're at sort of treetop level to the park itself.
We've just come up in the lift, John. Tell me where we are right now.
Well, right now we're on the 43rd floor, and it's one of the floor plans that has the wraparound terraces. That's kind of the one of the unique features. As you see the building from the tower from the outside, you'll notice that every 4 or 5 stories there is one of these wraparound terraces. It's a little cloudy today, but still it's a spectacular view. And the clouds kind of add to kind of a mystery and intrigue, and it's part of what's special about this building.
Okay, let's go and have a walk over to the window over here just to get a bit more of an idea of this view from up close. I don't know how you both feel, but there's something about New York when you're down at city level, it can be maddening, but somehow you get up high and it just becomes this whole new city, doesn't it?
Yes, it really does, because you can see all of the movement, and you can see it's fairly quiet here at this point, so you can hear some of the sirens in the distance, but everything here looks like it's in order, and you get a sense of how the city actually works, you know, and you see that there are patterns that of movement that are really hypnotic.
Although part of the success of the architecture of One Madison is that we were very sensitive to the fact that we were in a neighborhood that had historic landmarks, and most of the neighborhood is made of masonry. And instead of doing a tall building in blue glass or gray glass, we did it in a bronze-colored glass that was very sympathetic to the neighborhood.
Is there a sense that you're having to compete with these old buildings? How much of a consideration does it have to be when you start constructing a new building in this part of town?
You want to be aware of your context. We think that's an important part of our design motivation. But not to be a slave to the historic style. Obviously, I don't think anyone would think that One Madison copies any of the other buildings that surround the park. But there is a way to create a totally modern building in a context where people might be reluctant to make such an expression. And I think what One Madison proved was that it is possible that you can have, in this very historic part of the city, you can have contemporary architecture that can exist or surrounded by other landmark buildings.
The building started out really quite smoothly, and it was a great concept with a visionary young developer. But what happened was the recession hit, and really nothing was going forward, and he lost the property. Lucky enough, related companies and HFC Development came along and felt there was great value in the building. It was almost entirely enclosed, and most of the floors were finished. And working with both of the developers, we developed a building that was true to the original concept and really became quite successful. So I think it's a happy ending to a story that many buildings that stopped during the recession took different turns and were never built. But the idea that this building had such high quality and was such an iconic addition to New York enabled the developers to take a deep breath and go forward. And now the building is, as we understand, entirely sold.
Okay, John, can you tell us a little bit about who might be occupying the penthouse?
Well, I think it's an established fact that Rupert Murdoch purchased the triplex apartment at the top of the building.
Okay, Nancy, so I think you're going to talk to us a little bit about the interior design of the apartments.
The interior of the building was really designed to be homogeneous with the exterior of the building. And it's really a classic modernist building. And what's been so interesting is that what we designed on the interior within the apartments, which was designed 6 years ago, once we came out of the recession and the developers sort of brushed off the dust and looked at what was done, they found that it was had a very timeless feeling about it. So the reality is, as I stand here on the 43rd floor, we see all of the things that we designed in the original design of it. There's 9-inch wide red oak plank floors, which are the same as what were done. The kitchens are made of East Indian laurel with a beautiful Calcutta white marble trim. And all of, as you can see, the idea of the floor plans, which is so extraordinary about this building, is that every direction you look, we've planned the units so that there's a view out beyond, and you really don't get that in even other penthouse buildings. But our concept really was to hide the structure in the core that surrounds the elevators, and so that you literally, wherever you walk, you're getting a different view of the city.
That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker taking a tour of Manhattan's newest skyscraper, One Madison. This is Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Last week, Monocle's Guy Lutz headed down to the Citizen M Hotel in London to talk to the team behind what have become icons of British footwear, Clark's Shoes. The event there celebrated the 65th anniversary of the Desert Boot, perhaps the company's best-known product, worn throughout the generations since the 1950s. To mark the date, Clarks, in collaboration with the Halo Trust, asked 14 high-profile British artists to reinterpret the original design. Besides talking to Michael Powell, group director and senior vice president of Clark's Originals and Sport about the collaboration, Gaia had the chance to speak to Melissa Potter, CEO of Clark's. She started out by asking Melissa about the history of the centuries-old manufacturer.
Well, it would be a very long story if I started at the beginning, because Clark's is 190 years old and it is still owned by the family that founded the company in 1825. So it's had the same ownership over all of those years. And it started off as a very small company making sheepskin slippers in the southwest of England. Today, it's a company that has sales of £1.5 billion. We sell in about 130 markets internationally. Over 50% of our business comes from markets outside of the UK. And we sell to men and to women and to children. So it's actually got a very broad demographic. We only do shoes, though, so shoes is our specialism. And over our 190 years, we've continued to build our capability and our skills and our expertise in shoemaking. And that's still very much part of what drives the business today. So every single shoe that we design starts with a wooden last, which is hand-carved. Every single design starts with a white piece of paper that we cut patterns from. When I first joined the company, that was one of the first things I had to do, was to go on a shoemaking course and actually cut patterns and make a pair of shoes. So all of our designs start that way still today, although of course now we use 3D printing and computer-aided design as part of the process as well.
And obviously you've had a lot of collaborations and revamps in the past. How challenging is it to get a heritage brand and sort of try to modernize it without changing that very big, massive heritage?
Yes, well, it can be challenging, but I think that one of the reasons that Clarks has continued to be successful over so many years and continued under the same family ownership is because it's always respected its heritage and always been passionate about its specialism, which is shoes, but at the same time, it's had to keep challenging itself to reinvent itself for a new consumer and a new generation of consumers. So all the time, we've had to think about what is it that the consumer is looking for now, what's influencing their life, and what does that mean to us when we're producing shoes. So there's a very strong sense in the business of our heritage and the fact that we always strive to combine style with comfort. We position ourselves as an affordable brand. We want a lot of people to be able to buy us, so we're accessible, we're affordable. So there's some very strong DNA there, if I can describe it in that way. But that is always being challenged by what do consumers want today, and indeed what will consumers want tomorrow.
My name is Michael Powell. I'm the Group Product Director for Clarks Originals. Clarks is always within the Clarks Originals brand. We've always worked with collaborations, different artists, musicians, graphic designers in the past, as well as different lifestyle and fashion accounts. This isn't any different. I think the stature of the artist is a different level and the profile of the artist. But it really combines three things that are quite amazing at this point. Clarks has always had a strong commitment to philanthropy, a strong commitment to the arts and creativity, and as well, it's come together in a year where we're really celebrating the iconic status of the 65th anniversary of the origins of the Desert Boot. We are definitely targeting much more of a fashion and style influencing type of consumer, who really knows a lot of the history and the origins and the stories around the iconic silhouette. Clarks is a big brand that targets quite a broad base of consumers, and this is just one small part of it that's quite special. So the kind of creative process around the entire collaboration was we chose 14 artists, UK-based artists of pretty high international profile, and we really worked with them by sending them a box of ingredients that included everything from books on the brand, history of the brand, news clippings around the latest kind of collaborations and partnerships that we've done, as well as parts of the Desert Boot and information around the Halo Trust as well. And from then on, the project took on a life of its own, where the artists were kind of combining different points of view within their own conceptual artwork with the values of the Desert Boot and the Clarks brand, along with the Halo Trust. So each product is very unique in terms of the angle that they took.
So the Desert Boot, it was designed by one of the Clarks family, actually, a chap called Nathan Clark, who was a bit of an adventurer, a bit of a black sheep. I think the family would be happy and okay for me to say that. So he traveled the world a lot, and when he was in Egypt, he saw a boot in the Cairo Bazaar that was being worn by off-duty British army officers. And he went back to his tent. The story goes, and I have no reason to doubt it, that he went back to his tent and started cutting shoe patterns from newspaper that he had in his tent in order to make this boot. And what he wanted to do was make something that was as simple as it possibly could be in terms of design. So if you ignore the eyelets and the laces, there are only 7 pieces to a Desert Boot, which is an incredibly small number. Most shoes have about 120 pieces in them, so it's a very, very simple design. There are no extraneous design details on it. It's very pure and very unobtrusive. And when it first was launched, in fact, the Clarks company, when it first saw it, said that they didn't think anybody would want to buy it. So Nathan Clark ignored what the company had to say and went to the Chicago Shoe Fair on his own and set up a stand, apparently with palm trees around it, and just showed this desert boot to customers who were coming to buy at the shoe fair, and a lot of people ordered it. So it was regarded as being a little bit louche and a little bit risque at the time, because for men to wear shoes that didn't have a proper leather sole on them and didn't have a proper polished leather upper was regarded as not being quite the right thing to do. So it had a little bit of an edge even at that point, but then was quickly adopted by lots of people who wore it because it was incredibly versatile, because you can wear it with, and now consumers, you can wear it with jeans, you can wear it with suits. As dress codes are changing, it's actually a perfect product, which is very, very simple, appeals to lots of different generations. And I suppose this is a slightly cliched thing to say, but I would say it's a boot that you really wear. It's not a boot that wears you. It's like an old friend, you put it on, you can do what you want to do in it, and feel really comfortable and just get on with your life.
That was Monocle's Guy Lutz speaking to Melissa Potter, CEO of Clarks. You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where I'm bringing you Section D, our dedicated design show. Still to come today, we'll be talking about a new project using some very old imagery with Vitra, and then visiting Rio de Janeiro, where a museum's architecture is attracting more visitors to a once risky neighbourhood. With the early part of 2015 jam-packed with design fairs around the world, presenting new collections to wow at each one is often a challenge for the big brands who show at all of them. Last month, we heard from Vitra at IMM in Cologne. A matter of days after that, I ran into the Swiss manufacturer again at Maison et Objets in Paris, where they were launching a new venture, a collection of homeware and accessories, everything from trays to matchboxes, making use of the archive of Alexander Girard, the American modernist who dabbled in everything from architecture to textiles, to furniture to wooden folk dolls, which Vitra also produces. I caught up with Alexander's grandson Corey at the fair to discuss the new collection.
So tell us why you're here today. I mean, a great new venture for your family and for the Vitra brand as well, heading off here at Maison.
Yeah, we've been working with Vitra for a long time now. That's where the whole design archive of my grandfather's went when he passed away. And for many years, we've been slowly developing how to reintroduce the work in a relevant way. And so we're really excited right now to be sort of heading off the accessories collection at Vitra. And yeah, it's an amazing time.
So what's actually in the collection?
Well, the collection spans anything from plywood trays to wool blankets to wooden dolls to notebooks. So it's pretty diverse. And we wanted to start in a number of different categories, as he designed for over 100 categories. And it's pretty interesting to work with a company that has that sort of reach into production. Yeah.
Tell me a bit about the working process. I mean, how does it start collaborating with Vitra, going through the archive that the foundation has, and turning them into pieces of, you know, home accessories or whatever? How long did it take, and what sort of market are you aiming for with this?
For me, it started many years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years after we gave the archive. I started taking trips to really explore what was there, because when we first gave the archive, I was quite young and wasn't working in design the same way I eventually ended up. And so it was really like a series of treasure hunts every time I would go, because there were so many things that I had never seen and never knew that he had done. And really fascinating for me, as somebody who already had their own practice, to be showing up and discovering these things which were never actually produced on any mass level or anywhere that I would have seen them. Yeah. So then it really became an editing process more than anything else, you know. There are so many things, so many brilliant ideas. How do we then create a collection that fits together and that speaks a relevant voice for today? The product that we started with was the dolls, which was an extremely difficult product in that they were hand painted by him. And when I said maybe we could do this, Vitra said, I'm not sure if we could do this, you know, they're hand painted. But the brilliance of working with a company like Vitra is that they were willing to try, and they did. And in fact, they got it just right. And we've been working with folk painters in Poland to paint those dolls for over 10 years. So they're all hand-painted, and yeah, they have an incredible likeness to the original set.
And it becomes so iconic because of that.
Indeed, they sort of have become a Vitra mascot in some way, which is really nice. I mean, without having a real strong, specific religious background, he was a very spiritual person and was very spiritful. And everything he did had this whimsy and this humor that sort of gave a different edge to modernism that it wouldn't have had without his life. And so for me to have that as this mascot to this very clean Swiss-German company is an amazing, shows a lot on their end what they're willing to open to and how much it works.
And it's a real kind of important weapon in Vitra's arsenal at the moment as Vitra sort of heads into a slightly new direction, pushing homewares and things like that, would you say?
Oh yeah, I think that the Girard archive is an incredible asset at this point when you're moving into accessories, because literally my grandfather designed for over 100 categories. So anything that you want to produce, especially with, you know, the close relationship with the family and how we're working the archival product, it really is an endless, you know, pool of ideas for how to develop a very connected voice of graphic, you know, output or anything like this. So yeah, again, it becomes a tremendous editing process, you know.
So what next for the collection with Vitra? What do we think we'll be seeing in this time next year at Maisons in 2 years? Is this going to grow and grow?
It's a good question. It is definitely going to grow. How it will grow, I'm not exactly sure, because the way that we approach a collection is, I think, the way a collection should be approached. If and when the good idea appears, that's when you create it. It's not fashion. It's not like we're just going to, I mean, there are aspects to it that will continue to evolve just in the way that you've seen them. There's hundreds of color possibilities and hundreds of material possibilities. But in my mind, what's so great about working with someone like Vitra is that they're really conceptually based, as are we as a company. And we're interested in finding what kind of clever things can be brought into the light that wouldn't necessarily be by anyone else. So, you know, I would have never thought that we would be making match boxes with Vitra, but it's an amazing thing, you know? And I think it's, again, about looking at a different demographic, a different price point, and introducing more people to the world of design, and it's exciting.
That was Corey Girard there, talking me through new pieces using his grandfather's iconic imagery at Maison et Objet in Paris. The range is out soon and produced by Vitra. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll be back straight after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. To end the show now, we're going to go to Brazil. In Rio de Janeiro, creative architecture and design can be spotted nearly everywhere, even in locations that are far less travelled in the city. And Museu do Marais is a good example of that. It opened up back in 2006 as a museum to show the history of Complexo Marais, one of Rio's largest favela complexes. After threats to close down the museum over land rights, back in December, there was a victory for the museum as it was officially named a tourist attraction by Rio de Janeiro's Department of Tourism. This once flailing museum also received the Personality Award by the Institute of Brazilian Architects last year, which added an extra boost to its profile. Monocle's Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter visited the Museu do Marais to see how its new status helps open up new doors for the museum.
Driving down Avenida Brasil, one of Rio's main roadways, traffic is heavy, and the view of Rio's picturesque beaches becomes a distant memory as our car heads north into one of Rio's many working-class neighborhoods.
Rio da Maré, boa tarde.
And just off this main artery sits Museo da Mare. Founded 9 years ago, the museum sits on the edge of what makes up part of the Mare favela complex, an area of Rio that's comprised of 16 slums and a place where over 150,000 people call home. It's also an area that's been occupied by the Brazilian military since late March of last year. Mare has typically been a no-go area for many of Rio's residents and visitors alike, with a reputation of having the occasional violent shootout between the military police and local drug traffickers. It's understandable why. But Museu da Mare, a museum dedicated to teaching people about the area's history, is helping show the human element to the area.
Sim, o Museu da Mare foi criado a partir do desejo dos moradores.
Claudia Rosi is a coordinator of the museum. She explains how it first opened. She tells me that the humble beginnings of Museu da Mare actually date back to 1989, when a group of locals started TV Mare, a television station that was documenting daily life in the area. And as that TV station started to grow, she says, they decided to turn part of the community center into a museum, which was inaugurated in May 2006. Claudia Rosi takes me on a tour of the museum. From the outside, the museum looks like an unsuspecting factory. But when you step inside, that's when its character really starts to take shape. A wooden house that's raised up on stilts and painted different shades of blue shows visitors what the houses in the area used to look like. Back in the day, when local residents used to build their houses on top of a marsh that used to be here. As we go inside the model of an old house in Mare, the one-bedroom house is set up to look like how people used to live in the favela. An old gas stove sits beside the half-full canisters of white rice and black beans, which isn't far from a single cot bed in the corner of the room. All the exhibitions here in Museu da Mare come from the community. That being said, they certainly aren't your typical museum exhibitions. Claudia Rosi takes me more around the museum and points out one permanent exhibition. Lined on one of the museum walls is a smorgasbord of different sections of walls from houses here in Mare, and they all have bullet holes in them. In front of the makeshift bullet-ridden wall, a glass case sits on the floor, which is about knee height. And it's about a quarter of the way full with shell casings from bullets, all of which, sadly, come from the neighborhood. And the glass case slowly keeps filling up, as Claudia Rosi tells me. But of course, all these exhibitions that show a different school of thought in terms of design and which show a different piece of Brazil's history caught the attention of the Institute of Brazilian Architects, which awarded Museu da Mare with a personality award last year. President of the Institute of Brazilian Architects, Pedro da Luz Moreira, explains how Museu da Mare helps give traditional architects and museum curators in Brazil a different perspective on curation and design.
This city to be a city where can people stay together, poor people and rich people. That is important to the city because it's some kind of link of the city. That is important because poor people learn with rich people and rich people learn with poor people.
As Pedro da Luz Moreira explains, the prize from the Institute of Brazilian Architects awarded to Museu da Mare has helped include it in the greater scope of the city.
This last year, we gave a prize to the Mare Museum. This is so important for us because for the other side, we think about the Mare Museum and think that is a place where we can look for a culture that was made in this territory of the favela. Different kinds of people comes to Maré Museum. It's a space to think about. It's not a museum like a traditional museum. And so important to think about that in favela, favela is city too. And it's so important to do in favela to make part of our city.
But despite awards and a new status as an official tourist attraction in Rio de Janeiro, Museu da Maré still struggles to stay open. 47-year-old Marcelo Pinto Vieira, the artistic director at Museu da Maré, explains why. He tells me that Maré was an area in the city that was forgotten about for a long period of time, and that the museum was set up in an old abandoned factory, with permission from the owner, of course. He says, though, since the lease on the building expired about a year ago, the city has been looking to shut it down for the past year, since the owner of the property wants it back. He suspects the reason for that is because of the potential high property value of the museum's real estate, as this part of Rio gets a facelift. For Marcelo, the idea of the museum potentially closing is heartbreaking. Marcelo, who was born and raised in Maré, tears up over the possibility of the museum getting shut down. He says that the museum will continue to fight to stay open for the years to come, and that he hopes that the new official tourism status will keep it open for the coming generations. For the meantime, though, Museu da Maré remains open, and it's offering more than just insight into the history of the area through its exhibitions, but also offering community activities with reading groups and hip-hop lessons. And with the status of an official tourist attraction, the local community is hoping that that will be able to help it stay open for many years to come. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
That was Monocle's correspondent in Rio de Janeiro, Sheena Rossiter, bringing us that report on Museu da Maré. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, there could be nothing better to evoke the working life of a late 1970s office block than, of course, Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5.